And we'll talk with Dr. Nelson here, and if you have questions as we go along, you are welcome to call in. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number is 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, so that no matter where you are, you may use that number, and we'll pay for the call. That's 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
I suppose everyone must ask you how it is you got started in doing this kind of work.
It's a common question, but an important one, because you just don't go out and start studying bears on a whim. It happened when I was on the staff at Mayo Clinic. A friend of mine had come back from a meeting and said that bears go for a period of time without any food or water, and their temperature doesn't go down. And I was thinking out loud at the time, because we were at preparing or putting together nutritional management diets for people with kidney disease. Fortunately, that's come back again now with dialysis costs so high, because it's an important part of therapy. But at that time, we were just beginning, and I thought out loud, and I thought, be a great animal model for us to study. And my technician was standing nearby, and the next day he called me, and he said he could find three bears. And so at Mayo Clinic, there's an institute farm south of Rochester, and we housed the bears there and started out. Now, the main thing was to look at the waste product of the bear. If its temperature stayed up, and it does, that means that they're carrying on metabolism. That means they're generating heat. And we don't know of any animal who can do that that doesn't make the waste product from protein breakdown, which is urea. And, of course, that's what gets people in problems with kidney disease. They make more urea than they can get rid of, and when that happens, they have to go on dialysis or transplant. And I thought, well, let's look at these animals for one winter. Maybe they do make urea, and maybe it goes up to a very high level, but maybe they're just resistant to it. And if that were the case, I don't think we would have studied any further. But to our surprise, the urea that the bear started with actually went down, even though we had evidence that it made urea. So we, through a series of studies, finally realized that the waste product urea was recycled back into protein in the bear faster than the bear made urea. Now, humans, you and I, we recycle some of the urea we make, about 25%. But the bear actually was recycling more than 100% of what it made. Hmm. So it prevented uremia, what we call a life-threatening disease. So that started us, and we've been going ever since.
So, well, tell us up now, you are continuing to do this kind of research here. You have three bears.
That's right.
And what exactly is it that you do with your subjects?
Well, we really don't do invasive experiments. We want to find out how they do what they do. They're the most amazing animal. Through these 20 years, we can characterize the animal in the summertime very much like you and me. Walks around his hind feet a lot, hostile, seems to get involved with things that have no reason to do. I'm beginning to think they're like humans. But their metabolism very much like ours. You couldn't tell the difference between a bear after it ate or while it was fasting from you and me. Then in late summer, early fall, there is a signal to the bear, and we'd love to know what this is, that tells it has to put on fat for the denning period. And what is really amazing, that if we look at bears in the wild, they eat almost to a calorie the amount of energy they're going to need for that coming denning period. And if they don't do that, they get into trouble. And when food is short in supply, we have found bears in dens who have died, and they have uremia. So unless they have that energy, fat storage, they're not going to make it through that period of time. And so their eating behavior goes up. The grizzly bears were watched by Montana State University students in trees. The grizzly doesn't climb trees, and these students stayed in these trees 24 hours a day looking at the grizzly. And the grizzly ate during that period of time 20 out of 24 hours. And we know in captivity, our bears will go up in their food intake from 4,000 or 5,000, 6,000 calories a day, upwards to 20,000 calories a day. But then they'll stop. And they stop at a time when they have this energy storage. And there again, we'd love to know the signal that stops it. How do they know it? They have a very controlled obesity situation. And then they become what we call anorectic. They're not hungry. And then they enter the denning period. Now, during the denning period, everything continues. That's the surprise. Nothing is shut off. We know that in any living system, we don't expect organs to shut off because they'll atrophy. And the bears, every part of the bear continues. Even the kidney makes urine during this time. And yet the bear doesn't urinate or defecate. What it does do is the urine that enters the bladder is reabsorbed, goes back into the bloodstream. So the bear continues all this functioning, yet no urination, preserves its water, so it doesn't have to have any water intake. Now, it gets its energy from the fat, as I mentioned. They have to have the fat for energy. And they're unique. Bear is unique in the fact that by making protein out of the waste product urea, they actually end up at the end of their denning with a little more protein and a little less waste product. Now, no animal can do that. No animal. Human can't do it. When we starve or semi-starvation, eventually we reach a life-threatening situation when our protein stores have been exhausted. And that's about one-third of the total amount we have in our body. Even though we recycle that waste product just like the bear, we can only recycle 25%. And that sort of has kept us going because we do it. The bear just does it the best. The bear seems to have taken parts from what we call the deep hibernators, like the ground squirrel and woodchuck, what they do. It takes the good parts of what other starving mammals do, like prairie dogs who don't hibernate. And it has kind of put those together, you know, in an evolutionary sense that they're the most advanced animal to fasting. And what is really surprising, mating in the bear, the female, takes place in late June, early July. But it's called a delayed implantation. A lot of the carnivores have this, apparently. And the fertilized egg does not divide until October. And this is when the female enters her den. Now, she is in a complete starvation state in her den. No food, no water. Yet carries out successful pregnancies. And we now know in Pennsylvania with Gary Ault, he's a very energetic, flamboyant person that runs around in all those bear dens out there. We know that some of those females will have 5 cubs and yet will nurse them, successful pregnancy, successful lactation with complete starvation. Now those are 2-3 states that are just incompatible, but the bear can do it. But the interesting thing is when I get back to the male bear making protein out of urea, the male bear makes about as much protein as we find in 1 cup. So the male bear, in a sense, is pregnant. And we see no difference between males or females in getting through this period of denning. So the more I just talk about these things, the more amazing it gets.
It is very fascinating stuff. Let me just reintroduce for people who may have tuned in since the beginning of the program. Our guest is Dr. Ralph Nelson. He's the director of research for Carle Foundation. He's also a professor of medicine here at the U of I. We're talking about some research that he has been involved in, studying the metabolism of the bear. The hope is that by understanding that metabolism better, we can understand better some better understand and treat better some human problems. If you have questions as we continue to talk, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. I want to have you talk a little bit more about hibernation, since it is a commonly used term, you know, when people talk about bears hibernating, and that apparently it is not true hibernation in the sense that there are some animals that really, really do truly hibernate and is defined in a certain way, and that when you look at what bears are doing, there maybe are some important differences. Maybe you could talk about what true hibernation really is.
Well, if you look at true hibernation, And here on this campus, Dr. John Willis has spent a lot of his professional time studying the deep hibernators, what we call the ground squirrels and woodchucks. If you look at a definition for these animals, number one, their body temperature reaches ambient, close to ambient temperature, so it goes down a considerable amount. Their heart rate drops to very low levels. Their metabolism goes down to very low levels. And they also have a requirement that they will spontaneously rewarm if they get too cold. Now, the bear's temperature does drop, but it stays within what we would call normal limits. It only drops from 37 to 35 degrees centigrade. The bear's heart rate can go as low in dens, as low as 8 beats per minute. And we know its metabolism will drop, say, from 5,000 calories a day, maybe to 2,000 to 4,000 calories a day. So you can say, well, maybe they are hibernators. We have never done the test of cooling a bear down to see if it spontaneously rewarms. For instance, a rat or a human, if we were cooled, we would not spontaneously rewarm. Like, for instance, people who freeze to death in mountains and so forth, they do not have that quality. So I guess there are some similarities. But my experience now, and studying bears for 20 years, I would say they are not hibernators. Mainly because of this ability to make protein from the waste product urea. That is really the main reason for saying this, because the deep hibernators, like the ground squirrel, has periodic arousals. It will urinate. Sometimes it will eat. And it actually loses some of what we call its lean body tissues, its protein-containing tissues, during that time of hibernation. The bear does not. The bear actually ends up with a little bit more. And secondly, they get osteoporosis, these animals. If a human were to go lie, if we were just to lie in bed for a week or so, we'd lose an awful lot of calcium. Astronauts, the biggest problem in long-term spaceflight is loss of calcium. The deep hibernators, because they lie down, no weight bearing, they lose calcium. But we find the bear actually does not. Not only doesn't, it doesn't get any loss of bone. It makes bone equal to its bone loss, just like the rest of us who are weight-bearing do. And it's got the secret there, too. And I've come to the conclusion, too, that bears would not make it during the wintertime if they did get osteoporosis, because their calcium would rise to dangerous levels, which would be life-threatening. So I think they have to control this waste product urea, and they've got to keep the integrity of their bone. But just look at those two secrets that they have. I mean, it's unbelievable. And I would say because of that, they are not like deep hibernators. Mm-hmm. So I've gone back to calling them denning bears. But even today, I might say they hibernate. Be careful.
We have a couple of callers here to talk with.
Okay.
Let's do that. We also have two local lines that are free if you'd like to call in. The number is 333-9455. Our first caller is on line number one. Hello.
Yeah, I hope these are simple questions. One is, what is the weight and calorie content of the female bear between going into, well, whatever, denning, as you call it, and coming out? And then I think the other question is, does that compare with the gain in the fetus or the cubs? And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you very much.
Okay. Well, those are two really good questions, and we do have some information on it, but not enough. Let me just go back to the natural history of female bears. If a female bear is barren, is not pregnant, let's look at the Pennsylvania data because we have most information from that area. She may weigh about 120 pounds, let's say 150 pounds, when she enters the den. She doesn't have a cub. And when she comes out of the den, she may weigh 120 pounds. So she's lost about 30 pounds during that period of time. Now, if she has two cubs, she enters her den higher, at a higher weight than 150. She may weigh 160 pounds. But when she comes out of the den, having had two cubs and having lactated, and the cubs have growing to almost 10 pounds, 5 pounds apiece. When she comes out, she's 125 pounds, just like she had been barren. And the amazing thing is, bears, female bears seem to know how many cubs they'll have, and they'll go into the den at successively higher weights in proportion to the number of cubs, and the highest weight bear entering the den is the one that has 5 cubs. But that bear comes out at the end of this time at about 125 pounds. It's just amazing. To the bear, it isn't much different if she didn't have any cubs. It does not seem to be any relationship between the weight of the female and the weight of the cubs. Most of the cubs weigh around a half a pound when they're born, and they may be nursed up to maybe 5 to 10 pounds by the time they leave the den. Interestingly enough, the cubs do not behave like the denning mother as far as recycling their urea and prevention of osteoporosis. They are just like a growing dog or a raccoon, and there's a distinct difference between the two. So whatever factor or factors are controlling this beautiful reaction in the female, they do not seem to go across the placenta and do not seem to be secreted in the mother's milk.
That's very interesting. It seems that there are a lot of interesting things about this, but the fact that it is so well regulated that, and as I understand, if you weighed the bear before they went into their big eating period before going into denning, mm-hmm. and then you weighed them when they came out in the springtime, their weight would be where it was before they started. So they would take on exactly what they would need for their denning period.
That's exactly right.
And that they're, when they finish, they're at that same weight that they were when they before they started all, taking in all the extra nourishment.
Exactly. Is it fair to talk about polar bears at this point? Or?
Sure. Now, here's another interesting dimension, because polar bears, even though they don't have this inactivity period, they do something physiologically like the bears do that go into the den.
That's exactly correct. And we've been studying polar bears now over the past 5 years with people at the University of Alberta and Edmonton and the Canadian Wildlife Service, and we study these bears up near Churchill. The polar bears come ashore from the ice and are on the Cape Churchill area from the end of July until the first part of November. And during that time, they do not seem to eat or drink from all our studies and observations. And we're now doing some heavy isotope. These are non-radioactive isotope studies on those bears now to see if they have the same metabolic pathways as black bears. But anyway, they don't eat. They'll walk by through snow geese nesting areas, won't eat eggs. They will not kill the snow geese and eat them. They just seem to be lounging around. And near as we can tell, their metabolism is just like the black bears in the wintertime. Now, the interesting thing is when the polar bear goes out on the ice, the adult polar bears, they essentially kill seals for their food. And they restrict their food intake, the adults, to the blubber and skin. They do not eat any of the meat. And unfortunately, our zoos say because they kill seals and eat them that they're primarily carnivore meat eaters. But they stay away from meat almost exclusively, and they'll eat it right down to the muscle tissue. And finding bears in the wintertime, it's pretty dark up there. They look for the black seal against the white ice to find the polar bears that are out there. The polar bear will eat every 6 to 8 days, and we think this magnificent biochemical adaptation that we see in the black bear is in the polar bear all the time. So it really doesn't have to drink. And if it's like a desert up there. And if you the bear were forced to take in snow and ice at minus 30, minus 60 degrees centigrade, it would use almost all its metabolism to warm that up to get enough water to make urine. And most of the professional people there who have watched polar bears say they can count on the fingers of one hand the number of times they've ever seen a polar bear drink water. Now, the female polar bear, I think, has the record. If she's pregnant, she might come ashore at 400 kilo versus 200 kilo if she were not pregnant. 400 kilo is over 800 pounds. And so she's on Cape Churchill from late July until November when the when the when Hudson Bay freezes. Now, all of the polar bears then go out on the ice, but she goes into a den at that point. And she enters the den in November and doesn't come out till March, and usually will have two cubs. Now, from all the observations, she essentially has not had any food or water for 9 months and has had successful birth, pregnancy, lactation. It's an unbelievable animal. And I think the polar bear then is one step ahead of the black bear. We find the black bear really can't do what it does in the wintertime, in the summertime. But the polar bear seems to be able to do it at any time when there's no food available. Mm,
very interesting. We have another caller here. Let's talk with this person on our toll-free line. Hello.
Hello. Have there been any brain studies done on the black bear during its period of hibernation?
Very little. It's interesting you bring that up because most scientists that I talk to have asked me the same question. And maybe we can get at that now with bears in captivity. We have to have bears in captivity because the logistics of doing our studies in the wild are just too difficult. But that would be a very important study. But to my knowledge, brain waves have not been studied in black bears during their denning.
Would there be any correlation between the brain patterns and this hibernating phenomena?
We don't know.
You don't know at all.
No, it's a good study, though.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. We'll talk some more with our guest, Dr. Ralph Nelson, in just a moment. We'll go back to the phones again and to line number one. Hello.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering about the physiology of the Asiatic black bear or the black bear of the southern Mississippi swamp country in Louisiana. Does that seem to be similar, or do they lack this same ability?
I'm glad you brought that question up because one of our first bears was a Himalayan bear, and Himalayan bears do den in trees near the Himalayan mountains. But we know much more about bears in the southern part of the United States. We know that bears will den in Florida. They do den along the coast of the Gulf of Mexico. They den in Arizona when the ambient temperature may be 50 or 60 degrees Fahrenheit, and they den in Kentucky and Tennessee. The thing they have to be careful of in that situation is that they are protected from having to pant to regulate their body temperature. They make enough water from fat breakdown to meet their losses through their respiratory tract. But if they had to regulate their heat, then they do become overheated and will come out of their dens. The bears along the coast of Louisiana that den, the person who studies those animals feel that they are the Minnesota bears that were brought down from Minnesota years ago, the few that stayed down there.
Okay.
Excuse me. If I could just say a few words about translocating bears. They're rather interesting. We know that a nuisance bear will always be a nuisance. And people, say in Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan, who might have nuisance bears in their backyard, call the DNR. They'll come out with their traps, trap the bear. But they know that that bear is going to come right back where it was a nuisance. They've had bears swimming miles from islands in Lake Superior where they've taken them to come back to be a nuisance. And the only thing that seems to deter them is if they'll get shot during the hunting season on their return. Some years ago, Maryland wanted to start a hunting season to increase hunting revenue and asked Pennsylvania to translocate a lot of the bears into Maryland so that they could sell hunting licenses. And almost to a bear, they went back to Pennsylvania at great cost to Maryland. Gary Altes figured out how to do this. He'll take a cub. If sometimes mothers leave cubs in the wild, if he finds a mother with cubs, he'll go into the den, anesthetize the mother, put Vicks Vapor Rub in her nose, and add the cubs to her, to the litter that's there, and she will accept the cub under those circumstances. So that's one way.
Okay, I was also wondering how, for instance, the grizzly bear handles...
Excuse me, I didn't hear your...
Yes, I was wondering, have you studied the why the grizzly bear seems to be able to handle high elevated cholesterol levels and Homo sapien isn't able to handle it as safely?
No, we have no answer to that. But it isn't just the grizzly. It's the black bear and the polar bear. They have elevated cholesterols, triglycerides, and free fatty acids during the denning period. And the polar bears will have it during the summertime when they're not eating.
Right.
But I don't think they show atherosclerosis, but there hasn't been enough autopsies of animals who have died.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. On to another caller here, line number two for our next person. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. Dr. Nelson, I'd like to know whether or not in the denning period the bears are primarily aerobic or whether they go into a high glycolytic rate in their metabolic process.
No, they practically use no glucose whatever.
Ah, is that so?
That's true. They form glucose. We know they do. They form it from the substances that we do and other animals do. They form it from glycerol that's released from fat and alanine and serine. But the actual combustion of glucose is very, very low. We can tell that by respiratory quotients, and the respiratory quotient essentially is of pure fat combustion.
Okay, what's the partial pressure of CO2 in the bloodstream of these animals?
As I recall, it's just about exactly normal. It's around 40 millimeters of mercury.
Oh, be jiggy.
You can't tell if they've been without food for
yes,
6 months or have been eating and drinking normal.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much.
Could I just mention one other thing that comes to mind? One thing is that they have almost an arrogance towards cold. We work with Dr. Dave Garshelis, who is in charge of all the bear studies in northern Minnesota, Grand Rapids, Minnesota, and without his help, we wouldn't be nearly where we are. And he has showed me animals that will den right out on the ground with no cover whatever, shake the snow off all winter long, and it gets down to 40 degrees below zero, and he has female bears who have delivered cubs under those conditions and have no problems whatever. They're unbelievable, really.
It's a remarkable animal.
It is.
Yes, thank you.
All right, I thank you. Well, we have talked about what makes these bears special. We've talked about this ability they seem to have to, and correct me if I say this wrong, to convert urea into protein.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
So in a sense, they are recycling their waste. And also they manage to ward off osteoporosis.
Exactly.
That would be the result of this long period of inactivity. Mm-hmm. Do you think that somehow the same mechanism in the bear is responsible for controlling both of those things?
We do at the present time. I think the best thing I ever did was come down to the University of Illinois to work with the people here. We work with Dr. Janice Barr in reproductive physiology, John Willis, Dr. Ken Reinhardt in organic chemistry, and Dr. Jim Heath in in physiology and biophysics. And it's through all of these studies that I'm beginning to believe that the control of the bone formation, which is the crucial thing to prevent osteoporosis, is very similar to the formation of protein from urea. They both are what we call anabolic functions. They actually form net protein, and each one has to do that to survive. So I think it's of the same process. Hmm. We have, can I mention some of our graduate students here?
Sure.
Pat Myers is a graduate student in nutritional sciences who has isolated substances that are produced by the bear during the denning period. And we think they are potent metabolic factors. And she's done this with Dr. Reinhardt. And we've had Karen Horan, who's working with Dr. Barr, in doing a mapping process of what we would call the hypothalamus and pituitary interaction. You see, if a bear is starving and yet pregnant, there has to be two sets from the hypothalamus, which controls the pituitary. And by understanding that situation, it may well be the ability of the bear just to secrete the factors of pregnancy in concert with the factors associated with fasting, such that the two are compatible and produce the state. So it may well be this anabolic function is more related to that than any substances. But we also know there are other aspects of these substances which are important. So we're working hard on these problems. We have Bob Miller and Alex Adams has worked with us on bears. So it's been a very close-knit, interesting group, and I've yet not to find a person interested who has the expertise that would relate to what we need to do.
Well, let's talk about how eventually you think this is going to benefit human medicine. What is it that you are hoping that you will be able to learn that you can then use for example, and we've talked about people who have kidney problems or people who are suffering from bone loss?
What we hope, and we actually have some data that would support this thought, is that the bears, whatever the substances that are involved with this, what I've called anabolic function, they are produced in other animals, including the human, but not at a high enough level. So that if we find out what these substances are, and then can find them in the human, but at much lower concentrations, then I would see for a person with kidney disease that, that it might control the urea that they produce so that they can go along without having to have a transplant or go on dialysis, because they can get rid of the urea that they make or maybe even recycle it like the bear. And the same with osteoporosis. It's like diabetes mellitus. Most diabetics who are on insulin produce insulin, but they don't produce enough. So I think if we are going to be successful, the most fortunate thing that could happen is that we can find the bear substances that the bear has to have to do this in humans, but then these substances could be accentuated pharmacologically to produce effects.
So then, like taking insulin, someone with kidney disease would maybe daily have to take some kind of...
And we started out with this idea 20 years ago. It isn't just an idea that's been picked out of the air, and it seems like we've made progress every 3 to 5 years during this past 20 years, and we've made an awful lot of progress these past 5 years here. We owe a lot to Carl Foundation for building the Bear Research Facility, because we wouldn't be where we are unless we can go out and get the samples from bears that we need to do the studies. And then we usually check all these in the wilds when we go up to see Dr. Garcellis.
So you just to make sure that somehow bears in captivity aren't doing something different than they would out.
Exactly. And so far we haven't seen that. Another interesting thing that these thoughts keep coming that aren't necessarily associated with your question.
But bears,
when they come out of their denning period, are not hungry and don't drink water. And this, they have what I call an umbrella of metabolic protection that begins before they go into the den in the wilds. They just hike around, they don't eat, they don't drink, and they have the metabolism ready for denning. And they can go in the den anytime they feel like. And many of them have that a month before they go into the den in the wilds. So it's not related to snow or photo period or any of
anything
that.
Like that.
They just can do it. Mm-hmm. But when they come out of the den, that persists. It persists at a time when there's probably frozen, water's frozen, and there isn't any food. And it persists for at least 3 weeks in captivity.
So it has good adaptive sort of function there, because when they come out, if they were ravenously hungry, there might not be anything around for them to eat.
And, we owe a lot to Art and Andy Bush, who take care of our bears. Without their care, we wouldn't be where we are either. It's just as all seem to work together here.
About 10 minutes left. Our guest is Dr. Ralph Nelson. He's director of research for the Carl Foundation and is also a professor of medicine at the U of I. And we have been talking about some research that he's been involved in for a number of years, studying the metabolism of black bears. If you have questions, something further, that's something we've not touched on yet, you can call. The lines are free. Our telephone number here, Champaign-Urbana, is 333-9455 or WILL. And we have a toll-free line also. That's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-WILL. Is there also some thought that perhaps by studying these mechanisms that trigger the bears to eat or to stop eating, that there you might learn something that would be applicable to human eating disorders like anorexia?
David, we feel that that's the case as well. It's just that our hands are full, you know, now with what our studies are. But we'd give anything to know what the stimulus is to eat in these animals, because it's a sudden stimulus and they just get going. And then it turns it off. We suspect the fat cell will have something to do with it. It has been suspected many years that fat cells, when they become full, will secrete a substance which will then inhibit food intake. And that may be one of the mechanisms. But what turns on food intake in an animal that has a normal amount of fat, we don't know. But certainly it would be something for anorexia nervosa, the eating disorders, and for turning off food intake, conversely, for people with problems with obesity.
Hmm. Another caller here on one of our local lines, number one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me if there's been any observation of personality changes in these bears?
Associated with denning, you mean?
Yeah. Or over the function, like over a year's time, are there different personality traits? Talked about aggressiveness at one time.
It's a good question. We do see different personalities in the bears, and there is a establishment of a pecking order in captivity. The bears are awake during the denning period, and we cannot get close to them, and they're pretty much like they are during the summertime when they're active. But we have not noticed the behavioral aspects that much with our work. They have been studied rather extensively, but I haven't kept up with that literature. But I would say, essentially, their personality really doesn't change. They act, and we can predict their reactions pretty much winter or summer.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks.
All right. We're all open for questions. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Well, you talked about the fact that you have identified substances that you see in the animal that mm-hmm. you suspect may be related to controlling these important functions we've talked about. Once you are able to do that, you isolate these things, then what would be your next step? Would you try to construct some experiments where you would inject those substances mm-hmm. in another kind of animal and see what would happen?
It's a big problem. First of all, the isolation that Pat Myers is going through in Dr. Reinhardt's laboratory, it's a very highly sophisticated type of procedure and uses just the top type of equipment to get at this. And since we don't have much biological specimens, she has really concentrated on this over the past 2 years. But she's very close now to understanding just exactly these substances. But the other hand, we have to do what we call biological assays. Is there a type of response in a non-denning, non-hibernating species? And we've chosen the guinea pig and the raccoon. We've chosen the raccoon because it's rather close to the bear as a carnivore, but the raccoon does not hibernate or den. Well, it dens, but it doesn't. It continues to eat. It isn't like the bear. And the guinea pig being completely divorced from the bear, but a laboratory animal that we can look for responses. So it's a matter first of looking at general responses. The bear does show a slight decrease in temperature, so we would look for that. Mm-hmm. The bear does show a decrease in heart rate, so we would look for that. The bear's metabolism decreases, so we can easily measure their oxygen consumption. and we can look for that. So we have to get quantitative data in relationship to amount given. First of all, do these reactions occur? And secondly, if they do, can they be quantified and related to the dose that we give the animal? So that's on our plate now, and we have to get started on that.
Can you get enough of the substance that you're using from your subject bears, or have you broken that down chemically and then you're making it essentially?
No, we haven't not been able to synthesize it yet. And we do get samples from bears from up with Dave Garshelis up in Grand Rapids, but we get samples from people in Wisconsin. Lynn Rogers from Minnesota sends us samples, and we collect samples in polar bears. We haven't really seen any difference in the spectrum of substances in polar bear blood versus black bears. So we have we're beginning to build up a supply of samples, and we find that the substances that Pat is looking at are very stable, which is also fortunate.
Someone here to talk with on our toll-free line. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. In the matter of osteoporosis, wherein supposedly human females lose bone because of a lack of estrogen.
Yes.
Have you done any studies with older females at their levels of estrogen?
Are you talking about humans or bears?
The bears.
No, we really haven't, but with Dr. Barr now, we have a pretty good idea of change in the sex hormones with denning.
Uh-huh.
The interesting thing, most of our data now concern the male, but the male bear, while it is starving, it actually starts to produce testosterone, the male hormone. And its testicles become enlarged, and it behaves, it gets to a point where it is making testosterone at a level equal to the time when it mates in late June, early July. And this is occurring under a complete fasting situation.
Yes.
And we do know that successful pregnancy, progesterone and estradiol are produced throughout this period of time despite the fasting.
In the female.
In the female,
okay.
We know that, and we know that the male bears are making bone equal to bone destruction during this time.
Yeah, but you don't have any data on older female bears.
No, we don't. You know, we don't, in the wilds, the average lifespan of a bear, because of hunting, is maybe 6 or 7 years.
Oh.
We had a female bear who was 26 that was killed by a poacher up in Minnesota. It was really tragic. It is too bad, but in captivity, in the zoos, bears will live to be quite old age, but and there are two female bears in the Toledo Zoo that have just set the record for length of time in a zoo. They're 34 years old.
You can't do any analysis of their bone?
No, we can't. In zoos, zoos are very, very cooperative, but we cannot give them anesthesia to check on how they're making bone and things. They see the zoo as the last refuge for these animals, and their objectives are different than ours, but certainly we've had a lot of cooperation from them.
Possibly when an old bear dies, you may be able to do an autopsy then, get some data that way?
Yes, it's a good idea. It's a good idea, and we will. You know, we work. Tim Floyd is an orthopedic surgeon out in San Francisco, and he's getting bears now out in Yosemite, and he's looking at the bone. So we may have an answer to that. Who knows?
Very good, excellent program. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Well, we have come to the end of the time. Very, very interesting. We appreciate you being with us.
It's a pleasure being here, David.
Our guest, Dr. Ralph Nelson, is director of research for Carle Foundation, and is also professor of medicine at University of Illinois.